Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, I told you if we start talking about music, people get uptight. I told you that, didn't I?
You have mentioned it, yes.
A time or two. All right. Well, I'm going to indulge this topic for a little while longer, only because music is so important in our lives and it has such a profound effect on us. This one comes in from Jacqueline, listening in Houston. Thank you for sending it, Jacqueline. Relevant Radio is a Catholic talk show which promotes Catholic ideals, right? I grew up when you did. And she said she was born in 1958. So yes, I understand the attraction to rock and roll music, but it is not all good. On Catholic radio, good examples of music should be promoted. This is not about our likes and dislikes because your show affects everyone listening. There is classical music, church hymns, Gregorian chant, folk music, which I see you're doing on Taco Tuesdays. I don't think we've ever played a folk song on Taco Tuesday, unless you're using the word folk in a different way from what I understand. But in any case,
I don't think you let me play folk music on this show.
Remember the Rooftop Singers? Walk right in, set right down. That's folk music. But anyway, maybe she's just using it in a different way. In any case, so she says, study it, Patrick. The history of the church, of church music, edifies our faith and draws people closer to God. The Beatles don't do this. The reason I'm emphasizing it because there are a lot of exclamation points here. A priest once told us on a pilgrimage that music is composed of essential elements like melody, harmony, and rhythm in that order. Reversing this order appeals to the lower senses, our passions, and played with more volume and repeatedly can have, and then the email cut off. So I'm sorry, I don't know what the rest of your email said, Jacqueline, but well, I respectfully submit to you that I have studied this. I don't claim to be an expert in it, but I mean, I've studied music theory. But I've studied the effects of music on human beings, and the book that I referenced earlier is called Music and Morals by Father Basil Cole. That is a Thomistic analysis of this very issue. So I hope it pleases you to know that I have indeed studied it, and I am well aware of the issues that you're talking about. But I think maybe you might be a little more stringent in your application of this issue. So I would recommend that book to you. Check it out, Music and Morals, How Music Affects Our Humanity. And thanks again for sending me the email. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Dave now in Wrightstown, Wisconsin. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. How are you doing, Patrick?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to make a couple of comments. One, you know, you guys do an awesome job there, you know, thank getting you. The gospel message out on the radio as another form of going to church, reading the Bible, you know, all great things that are getting the message out there. And I guess I think the topic today kind of falls on stumbling blocks. And, you know, as I'm hearing the different things from yoga to music, the Bible pretty clearly specifies that it's what's in your heart. You know, at the time, you know, it's not what you eat, you know, and I think by somebody celebrating Jesus Christ through traditional music, that's fantastic. Somebody celebrating Jesus Christ through more modern Christian music, fantastic. You know, it's the same thing. It's a personal preference, and I came to Christ through music. So I can tell you that the lyrics in songs are extremely important. And, you know, I hear even witnessing in modern music is, you know, some of it is very clearly somebody coming to Christ.
Right. Dave, are you defending praise and worship music? Or because I've said it like 10 times today, I'll say it again. I don't judge or look down on anybody if they disagree with me on this topic. And I recognize that probably if you took a poll, most people would disagree with me on this topic. I just happen to not like that genre of music. But I'm not, you know, I don't say to people that that's terrible that you like it. I'm not sure if that's what you're wondering about, is it?
No, I'm just more or less saying about a stumbling block. I think it's fantastic, Patrick, that you worship through the more. I love, you know, side play piano, the Silent Night, you know, these old traditional songs, and I feel they're very spiritual. But I also can turn on something more modern, and I wouldn't say I would put a stumbling block in front of somebody to say, you know, if you're doing yoga, God bless you if you can put your body into a position like that and you're relating to Jesus Christ at that time. That's a great thing. If you're thinking of something else, not related to Jesus Christ, well, that's a bad thing. But it would be wrong to say you shouldn't do it. If you're in the right state of mind and your heart is following Jesus, that's what it's about.
Well, that may be true in a certain sense, Dave, or up to a certain point, but what I was saying earlier is that because yoga has a tendency to draw, people become fascinated with it. I mean, I know that only anecdotally, but I've met many people who have become truly fascinated by yoga. And they're, in some cases, even enthralled by it. And what happens is, for some people, maybe not most of them, but for some people, it becomes something more than just merely stretching and exercise, and it draws them deeper into these efforts at mystical experiences and meditation, etc. And all I'm saying is that can be dangerous. So as St. Paul said, you know, test all things and hold fast to that which is good. So we should test them, including things that might seem harmless, but in fact could be not harmless for the right people under the wrong circumstances. That's all I'm saying.
And you had a great point, and I'll reiterate kind of what you said in that the Bible talked clearly about self-control and not overindulgence in any one thing that are blessings to us. And again, if you don't take it to that level and all you're doing is experiencing Jesus in any of those activities that you're talking about today, I think it's fantastic, and why would I judge somebody who's being with Jesus in their own way? It might be different than my way, and it has to probably be, because no two people are alike, and probably no two relationships with Jesus are going to be identical.
I don't think you're hearing what I'm saying, though, Dave. You and I maybe are talking past each other, because that's not what I'm referring to. What I'm saying is that if a given thing can wind up becoming harmful to somebody who's not careful, then it's worth mentioning it. It's worth letting them know. There are some things that are never harmful to anyone. You know, drinking water. You drink a glass of water, that's good for you. And you're not going to harm yourself. I mean, I guess if you drank a billion gallons, it's going to harm you, but just in general. But there are other things you can drink for pure enjoyment that can wind up harming you over time. So there's nothing wrong, I don't think. I'll leave it at this. There's nothing wrong with pointing out that some things do have inherent possible dangers in them. And to speak up about
agreed.
It.
And
okay. Okay.
And I'll just maybe end with, we're on the same team, Patrick. And I think we ask sometimes as Christians the wrong question. So somebody going down the street with a "I love Jesus Christ" sign, he's on our team. It doesn't matter, you know, what denomination he's supporting. I mean, if his main message is, you know, repent, come to Jesus Christ, he's on our team. We don't need to ask any more questions. And I think as Christians, sometimes we ask too many. You know, we don't recognize even who's on our team. You know, I can tell you're on my team because I hear the Holy Spirit working through you. And I hope you hear the same thing through me. Now, if I wasn't a Catholic, would that be different?
Well, I mean, if you weren't a Catholic, then you would disagree with some of my beliefs and vice versa. So, I mean, there's nothing, it's not inconsistent with accepting other people for who they are and respecting them and working together wherever you can, and at the same time acknowledging real differences. So, for example, Jehovah's Witnesses will tell you that they love Jesus, but they'll also tell you that Jesus is not God. He's just a creature.
But they would be, that's wrong. So, I mean, that's a wrong teaching.
Right.
That you can't, they're not on our team.
Well, but you said that if you see somebody who says a bumper sticker that says "I love Jesus," that they're automatically on our team. I don't think it's as simple as that. And it's not that I'm trying to exclude anybody, but rather draw attention to the fact that somebody loves Jesus doesn't mean that everything he says is necessarily correct. And there are some things that people who love Jesus believe that are deeply incorrect. You know, there are Mormon friends and listeners right now who love Jesus, but they believe that there are many gods, and they believe that they can become gods in the afterlife, you know, when they reach exaltation. And that is a, you know, a deeply...
It's not consistent with the Bible, though. So, I mean, so, yeah.
That's my point.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying, Dave, is that just to say, because I have a slogan that says I love Jesus, that means we're on the same team. It doesn't mean that. It could mean that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that.
But I'm saying that you identify him as your Savior and that none of us can reach heaven without him. You're on our team. You know, if the love Jesus means, if it didn't, doesn't
Mormon
mean that,
that,
it isn't the same team.
Yeah, Mormons say
that. That you have to go through Jesus Christ to get to heaven.
Yeah, yeah, they do.
Hmm. Well, they're right about that. I guess
they
I don't
are,
know
but
much
they
about that.
They have a very wildly different way of understanding what that means. Anyway, Dave, I understand it, and I appreciate your Irenic spirit. Thanks for calling in, and I hope you'll call again. Thank you. Let's go now to Sue in Oak Brook, Illinois. Hi, Sue.
Yes, hello. Good morning, Patrick.
Yes.
So this is a totally conjecture question, just okay. Something I've thought about through the years. If Adam and Eve had not sinned, right, they would not mm-hmm. have been kicked out of the Garden of Eden.
Right.
And I think one of the, I don't know that it's the word graces, there's a term for that, but I think one of the things then, if they had not been kicked out, was immortality for everybody. And, you know, any of the ensuing generations, you know, from Adam and Eve. So I thought about that. I'm like, so then what happens to all the people? How does the world hold all that? I mean, I know the world's pretty big, but this would be generations of people. So again, right. It's a big if, a big conjecture question. Just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
I do, as a matter of fact. You're talking about the space, if I understand it correctly, the space in the world. Would it have been large enough to accommodate all these countless billions of people who obviously aren't here because they've died over the years, or many millions of them have? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, yeah. How would that work? I just thought, well, maybe you might have an idea, and you said you did. So I'm interested in hearing.
Okay, sure. So my thought is that if we consider that the Garden of Eden was somehow different from the rest of the natural order. So it wasn't subject to the laws and restrictions that certainly the world after the fall was subject to, the futility that was brought in because of sin. And so I think maybe what we could say is that in a way that has not been revealed to us is that just as the Garden of Eden before the fall was pristine and properly ordered so that human beings and animals coexisted freely without any problem, and human beings didn't have to work because the food was in abundance for them, etc. I suppose we could also extrapolate that would mean that the nature of the world before the fall was somewhat different, in that maybe it was expansive to the point of, you know, infinity. It wouldn't be infinite in itself, but you know, maybe the distances were far vaster, or could have been far vaster, or there never would have been an end to how far and how many people could have populated the earth. It's a very fascinating question. I've never really thought of it before, but just extrapolating from the things we do know about the Garden of Eden, I don't see any reason why we couldn't assume that its proportions would not have been much bigger and more accommodating.
All right. And so then maybe then you would just already have your heaven on earth, and you really wouldn't need a heaven, maybe?
Possible.
Yeah.
It's all,
I know,
like
it's
you
all
said,
conjecture.
It's all conjecture.
Just something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's another thing to think about. We do see a glimpse of something similar to this in Revelation chapter 21 and 22, where we see the new heavens and the new earth arriving after all the elements have been dissolved by fire, and the new heavens and the new earth are manifested. I think that is a way of saying that what we think of today as like this earthly life, and then there's the supernatural life in heaven, that those two realities merge into one single unified reality. Now, this, I think, may be part of an answer to your question, because for all those people who have ever lived and who are among the elect, we will all be together in the new heavens and the new earth. And who knows how many billions and billions and billions of people that is. So there's clearly not going to be any limit. We're not going to be cramped. We're not going to be jostling with one another for space. There'll be more than enough space for everybody. And I wonder if maybe the Garden of Eden might have been in a reality something like what the new heavens and the new earth are going to be when the time comes. It's another interesting clue.
Right. Okay.
All right. Yep. Well, thank you, Sue. Fascinating questions, no doubt about that. Let's go to Han now, listening in North Arlington, New Jersey. Hi, Han.
Hi, Patrick. I have two questions regarding to the Holy Souls in Purgatory. The first one is, if I offering the Mass intention for one person, but two different Masses at two different parishes, in the same day, would the person receive extra graces, or the person would just receive one grace regardless how many Masses I do within, how many Masses I offer in the same day? Also, the second question is,
Let me just do the first one first.
Okay.
So if you went to Mass two times in one day and you offered the Mass intention for, let's say, the soul of somebody in purgatory, the soul in purgatory would receive the benefit of two Masses. If you went to one Mass, the soul would receive the benefit of one Mass. Am I understanding your question correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what was the second question?
And the second question is, if I offer the Mass for the souls in purgatory, do I have to attend the Mass myself in that day? Because sometimes I feel guilty because I usually offer a lot of Masses for the Holy Souls in purgatory, but I can't really make to the Mass myself. It's only on the important feast days, but not like every time I offer the Masses. So I kind of feel like I abandon my families a little bit because they're like, okay, I'm able to do the Mass offering, but I'm not able to go to the Mass myself to offer the Mass for them.
You can make
in person.
Right. You can make a spiritual communion where you're not able to physically be present at Mass. And that's good, and it's very advisable, and you can offer any merits or spiritual benefit from that for a soul in purgatory. But that's not going to be the same as if you were at Mass physically and received Holy Communion there. It's good to make a spiritual communion when you can't get to Mass, but it's something different from and less than if you were at Mass. So you can do both.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, these are very interesting questions, and I'm glad you called today. Thank you. Break time. Okay, let's do that, and we'll come right back. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity Healthshare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
I like this. What is it? Oh, okay.
There you go.
I get it now. Good, good. Okay. Joel in Bozeman, Montana. Welcome.
Hey, good. Hi. This is Joel. And Patrick, Joel, on three different occasions in the past month, you have mentioned that, you know, I'm referencing the Civil War now, you have mentioned that the soldiers in the North were fighting to free the Negro, and that is absolutely not true. The whole Lincoln never, ever proclaimed the cause of fighting to free the Negro. The Civil War was fought for one cause, and that was to preserve the Union. When the South fired on Fort Sumter, it was because they were trying to secede from the Union. We went to war with them to preserve the Union and nothing else. The Emancipation Proclamation was written it was ready to be promulgated about the third quarter of 1862, but Lincoln didn't promulgate it because he wanted to wait until there was a Union victory of a size that he thought the slaves would say rebel against their masters, but it never worked out that way. He didn't.
Joel, do you know why the Confederate states broke away from the Union? Do you know what their stated reasons
were? Sure, because they wanted to they broke away from the Union because they wanted their own state. They wanted their own nation.
Not exactly.
They didn't want the North. Because look at the 1850 compromise and all those.
I'm familiar with the history, but what I'm saying is it sounds to me like you don't really know from firsthand knowledge why the Confederate states broke away in the first place. I can share that with you if you'd like to know.
Well, you didn't. The fact is...
No, I'm going to share it with you now, Joel, because you got me going. So this is the declaration from the Southern states. It's called the Confederate States of America Declaration of the Immediate Causes which Induce and Justify the Secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union. And this was something that was adopted by the rest of the Confederate states. And this is all about slavery. And they talk about states' rights only insofar as they wanted to have the right to continue with slavery. So I'll give you some selected passages. The general government as the common agent passed laws to carry into effect these stipulations of the states. For many years, these laws were executed. But an increasing hostility on the part of the non-slaveholding states to the institution of slavery has led to a disregard of their obligations, and the laws of the general government have ceased to affect the objects of the Constitution. It talks about their objection to the current anti-slavery feeling that has led the North to more and more enact laws which render inoperative the remedies provided by her own law and the laws of Congress. That has to do with returning fugitive slaves, etc. They're referring to those in the North who denounce as sinful the institution of slavery. They have permitted open establishment among them of societies whose avowed object is to disturb the peace and to elloin the property of citizens of other states. It's referring to slaves, the property of other citizens, the human beings. They have encouraged and assisted thousands of our slaves to leave their homes, and those who remain have been incited by emissaries, books, and pictures to servile insurrection. For 25 years, they say, this agitation has been steadily increasing until it is now secured to its aid the power of the common government. And he goes on in this vein to say that the office of the President of the United States, whose opinions, are referring to Lincoln here, whose opinions and purposes are hostile to slavery, he is to be entrusted with the administration of the common government because he has declared that the government cannot endure permanently half slave, half free, and that the public mind must rest in the belief that slavery is in the course of ultimate extinction. They say on the 4th day of March next, this party will take possession of the government. It has announced that the South shall be excluded from the common territory, that the judicial tribunals shall be made sectional, and that a war must be waged against slavery until it shall cease throughout the United States. So they're quoting the federal government. They're quoting Lincoln. And they're saying that their reason for going to war against the North was to preserve slavery. Now, states' rights is certainly part of that. It's inextricably part of it. They're asserting their right as a state, But you, sir, are woefully incorrect if you think that this was not, both in the North and in the South, recognized as a war about slavery. I'll turn it back to you.
It was a major issue, I agree. But when the question comes up, why was the war fought? It was fought to preserve the Union by the very words of, and I'll find my little book on Lincoln's, it's not one of his, in one of his speeches, but he was so adamant about preserving this Union that we would.
There's no doubt about that. I don't deny that. But yeah. But you seem to be of the mindset that slavery really had nothing to do with it in the North, and that's simply not true.
No, I didn't say that.
All right, Joel. I don't know how effective this is going to be. Anyway, I read to you what the Southern position was and what they had to say, and I hope that sheds more light on it. I just don't know how valuable it is to wrangle over this, but thank you. Let's go to Patrick now in Albuquerque. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Patrick. Good to talk with you. Great to always listen to you.
Well, thank you.
Just a quick question. I came in and out of the conversation just a little bit ago.
Okay.
About Adam and Eve, Eden, and how populated I think the world would be if, you know, if nothing happened or if they didn't eat the apple. Was that kind of what I was thinking of?
Yeah. Yeah, a lady asked the question
about...
Well, she had asked the question about, in essence, could the earth be big enough to hold all those people who would not have died if Adam hadn't sinned?
Yeah. Right. I heard your answer. I just didn't hear the question. But anyway, mm-hmm. This is maybe a follow-up to that or a precursor to it. Do you know how long Adam and Eve lived in Eden before they ate the apple?
It doesn't tell us.
Quite some time? Was it the next week? Or
it doesn't tell us. It just describes the creation story, and then it talks about how God created Adam, and then he created Eve, and we get a little bit of information about what they were doing, but we don't know how long they were there. Was it a year, 10 years? You know, we just don't know. We can only surmise.
I would think the longer, the more they would understand how good they had it, but
yeah,
who knows?
Indeed, yeah.
Just a question I had. I've been wondering about that, and I've always wondered, too, of how populated the world would be, too, if original sin didn't happen. So anyway,
yeah, it is
I
a fascinating
your thoughts.
You got it, Patrick. Thank you. It is a fascinating topic. Unfortunately, there's nothing hard and firm that we can say about it. We can only conjecture and then ask God when we get to heaven. Won't that be an interesting discussion? Let's go to Vian now in San Diego. Hello, Vian.
Hi, Patrick. I had a question about a friend of mine who, he's a good friend of mine from college and he's getting married. He's not Catholic, but mm-hmm. I found out, well, I had planned to go to their wedding. It's going to be in the East Coast.
Okay.
And then I didn't really ask him if his fiance is, you know, Catholic or Christian or anything like that.
Okay.
And I eventually, like, we were talking on the phone recently, and then he told me, I asked him, like, is your fiance, is she, like, what's her background? And then he mm-hmm. told me that she's Catholic, and he was really excited to tell me that because he knows that I'm a devout Catholic, and I think he was just excited to share that comment between us. And then I was a little bit sad in my heart because I had a feeling that I probably wouldn't be able to attend their wedding because they're not celebrating it in the church. So his fiance is not practicing.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask you about that. And I never thought I'd be put in this situation, to be quite honest.
Yeah, because you love your friend and you want to be able to support him and be there to celebrate. So maybe this is an opportunity for you to do a little evangelization and let him know, you know, the church requires you to get married in a church with the priest or a deacon, or it could be a bishop, as the official witness and representative of the church. And I would love to be there to celebrate with you. Have you asked the bishop if you could get permission to not celebrate your wedding that way? And he may say, well, no, I didn't even know I had to ask permission. Yeah, I mean, the bishop might give you permission, but you have to ask him for it. And the thing about it is that if you don't get married according to the church's canonical form, which is the term that's used to describe, you know, in the church with the priest or the deacon there, that you're not, it's not going to be a valid marriage. And I know you want to be married forever, and you want to, well, until death do us part, obviously. You want to do it the right way, and this would be the right way to do it. And for that matter, then I and all your Catholic friends can be there, because if it's not done that way and it's an invalid marriage, then it's really, you know, it's not possible for people to go and celebrate something that they know is invalid. So maybe you can kind of coax him that way and get him to see that this is something he should do. I would try that.
Yeah. Okay, I know. It makes me, I would like to be able to go, but it just put me in a tough spot. So I'll try that. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome. Because sometimes, you know, the old saying, you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. So sometimes you can actually accomplish a lot of good by, in a friendly and respectful way, inviting that person to do the right thing. Rather than condemning them for doing the wrong thing, why not invite them to do the right thing and help them if you can?
Right. Yeah, that's true.
I hope it works out.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I hope so too. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you, Vian. Nice chatting with you. 888-914-9149. How about Cindy now in San Marcos, Texas? Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, my friend. Patrick, a situation happened recently at a church where my sister started going to. She lives in a small town, Brownwood, which is in West Texas, and I live here. She has had a really life of suffering. You know, she had an abortion. She's been dealing with alcoholism for like 40 years. But she has, and suicidal a few years ago. Wow. But little by little, through the family and prayer, she has been finding her way back to the church. And I can tell how much she loves it when she's there. At Easter, I was with her and I bought her a little veil, and she was like a little kid. Well, recently, she told me they have a new priest. He's young, he's super nice, and he has a sense of humor. Now, that's one of the marks of my sister. She has an amazing sense of humor, but she's got a loud laugh. She said at one point during the Mass, she laughed when the priest said something, and the two ladies seated in front of her turned around and gave her like a real stink eye.
Yeah.
And I know she took it super personal. She called and told me about it. She's just like, oh, that's why I don't go to Catholic churches. Everybody's so stiff-necked and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But I know that laugh that she has, all that is a facade, because she is still experiencing so much suffering. Her life is like one crisis after another. And it's just by praying the rosary with us, even once a week, that Our Lady has been guiding her back to the church. Myself, as an addict for 45 years, it took me a long time to understand that that was a haven, that the church that my parents went to, and that's where Jesus was and is and will remain. And that's our haven. How difficult it is, Patrick, for people with terrible addictions or abortions or this incredible dislike for themselves and not having that intimate relationship with our Lord to even walk through those doors. So I need your wisdom. I want to say the right things to her to encourage her. That's where Jesus is. You know, people in the church, other people aren't perfect either. Those ladies, no, that wasn't the right thing. It really made me mad, but I was heartbroken for her because she hasn't been back to the church. Yeah. And I know she wants to be there. So can you help me with that?
I'll try. I don't know if I have any kind of like magic formula or, you know, do this and it will fix everything, because people obviously, when someone is wounded by being insulted or being, in her case, sort of put in her place by these women who scowled at her, sometimes emotionally it's hard to overcome that. It can be overcome, and emotions are difficult to contend with, as you know. My advice for what it's worth, Cindy, would just keep being the gentle, loving sister that you are. You obviously care for her, and I'm sure she knows that. You want her to be happy. You want to assist her however you can. I would just say you can be the face of the Catholic Church that she didn't see that day. You can be the kind of Catholic who's welcoming and encouraging and accepting, and keep letting her know that that bad experience that she had, that's not the church, that's those two people. And there are plenty of other people who would love to have her there and would welcome her. And if that particular church isn't the right place, then maybe to start going to Mass at a different church, you could tell her. I think encouragement, it sounds to me that encouragement right now could go a long way with her, you know, and help her see that that bad experience that she had isn't the end all and be all of the Catholic Church, you know?
Well, I like the way you put that. She got to start listening to you when I had you on during COVID, and she loves music. Our brother was a big Beatles person, and so I'm going to tell her I called you because she really likes you a lot. And let me just add that that's a great Steve Miller jam y'all had going a while ago. And thank you for just being such a good listener to everybody. It's really a godsend, Relevant Radio. So I appreciate it so much.
Thank you very much. Okay. She's lucky to have such a good sister in you, Cindy. And I'm lucky to have such a great listener. Thank you for that. I'll be right back. Hard to believe, only about 20 minutes left. But we'll get right back to it right after this. It's all right. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. This note comes in from Pam. She says, regarding praise and worship music, at a special celebration for one of our priests, the music was accompanied by drums. The musicians did a wonderful job, but I thought it was out of place. Then after one particularly rousing rendition, the congregation spontaneously started clapping. I thought that was totally out of place. Was I wrong feeling as I did? Well, I don't think so. Pope Benedict XVI, he had a comment. I wish I had it in front of me to quote it verbatim, but words to the effect that whenever in a, like in a mass setting, when you're at mass, outside of like a wedding mass where you introduce the married couple or maybe the ordination of a priest or the consecration of a bishop, there are some instances where I don't think Pope Benedict was referring to that kind of thing, but he says in general, at Mass, when there's applause, that means that people have lost their sense of what they're there to be doing, that they are now focusing on like a quote-unquote performance, and we're not there at Mass for a performance of the music. The music can be sublime and wonderful, and we are grateful to the musicians for providing us with such wonderful music, but they're not there to perform for us. It's there to help all of us to lift our thoughts and minds to God. So I can understand what you're referring to, and since you're asking my opinion, no, I don't think that you were wrong to feel that some of these things that you just mentioned were out of place. I have a feeling I probably would have felt the same way. Also, and Cyrus, you'll like this. This comes in from PJ, who's listening on the Relevant Radio app. He says of the John Wayne Pledge of Allegiance, he says, wow, beautiful. I so appreciate hearing this on the radio. Sad to ponder if many of the freedoms we'd had are even present anymore. That's a good point. We like playing that.
I told you so.
And also, a thank you again to those of you who are sending me the stories, links to the stories from people who, about the change of leadership at the Newman Center at Ohio State University. This email comes in from Don. He says, hi, Patrick. The gentleman who has Protestant friends who are confused who are convinced, rather, without any doubt, that they are saved and will be in heaven. I've heard this from other people, but not from Catholics. I wonder why. I do not know the Bible, but I know from my Catholic faith we are saved by the grace of God in belief in Jesus, who died for our sins and who said the same Spirit will raise us up. In this belief and in being in the state of the state of grace with God, I think you can still believe in Jesus but lose your salvation by not being in the state of grace. At least dying in mortal sin, that has not been confessed, and getting absolution from the Catholic Church. How do non-Catholics who have mortal sin get cleaned again? Can they just pray to God and forgive them of this mortal sin? And he says, thanks, I've learned a lot from you. And this is from Don. Well, Don, thank you. Well, if I understand your question correctly, the normative way to be saved, according to Jesus, he says, go into the whole world, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. So this great commission in Matthew 28, beginning in verse 19, tells us the norm. This is what Jesus intends for all of us. And those who can do that are obliged to do that. Now, for people who through no fault of their own were not able to do that, and that's a big question mark. Who are those people? Well, does that extend to, you mentioned Protestants. Does that extend to Protestants? Well, the Catholic Church says, and has always said, and continues to say, that there is no salvation outside the church. And it says it in very specific terms in section 14 of Lumen Gentium from Vatican II, which takes up this question about the necessity of the church. And it's very clear in saying that anybody who, knowing that the church is necessary for salvation, refuses to either enter into it or to remain in it, can be saved. So the key to remember is, if they know that they should be Catholic and receive the sacraments, and they don't, well, they're not going to make it. Because you ask what happens to their mortal sin. Well, if they know that this is where the Lord is calling them and they refuse that, they refuse the grace, they refuse to do it for whatever reason, you know, what did Jesus say? He said, if anyone who acknowledges me before men, I will acknowledge before the Father. But anyone who denies me before men, I will deny before the Father. And that's a form of denying Jesus by saying no to him if you know that you're supposed to be in the Catholic Church. But that, of course, leaves the question about what about people who genuinely didn't know? They didn't know. What about them? Well, the church says we leave that in God's hands and we trust in his mercy. So this is why we pray for people, including Protestant folk. We pray for them after they die, that God will have mercy on them. And so that's something that he hasn't revealed to us, how he takes care of that, but we believe that God is just and merciful. And that if it's possible for those people to be saved in a way that we don't know about, that God will take care of that. I hope that helps, and I appreciate the email. Let's see. Let's go now to, where are we? Let's go to Sylvia in Katy, Texas. Good morning, Sylvia.
Hi, Patrick. I'm calling, I guess, today because I wanted to follow up on a previous caller's question about marriage outside the church by a Catholic to a non-Catholic.
Okay.
And in a non-Catholic way of trying to celebrate that. So I have a family member that recently got engaged, and she is baptized Catholic, but has kind of taking a step away from the faith and just thinks that, you know, as long as she's cool with Jesus, you know, it's just between them that they're, you know, that she's good to go. Mm-hmm. And then her fiance is like, he's like evangelical or something like that. So anyways,
okay.
They kind of are leaning towards getting married in just like a civil ceremony. And I don't really know how to approach a situation knowing that, that's wrong because she needs to be married within the church, and B, she kind of rejected the faith, and I know she would reject what I have to say, like outright.
Right.
So how do you go about that situation, like trying to gently correct and or provide that information without pushing somebody away? And also on the note of the actual ceremony, like, does that mean like our family can't go to it if, you know, the practicing Catholics, or what does that mean exactly? How do we fix it?
Okay. So let's start there. There is a difference of opinion, or maybe to say it differently, two schools of thought on this issue. There are some people, including some priests I know, very fine priests, who would tell you, no, it's okay to go as long as you tell them that they shouldn't be doing this and that you disapprove of it or that the church disapproves of it. You should go anyway to preserve family unity and to keep that doorway of the relationship open. Now, I understand the idea behind that, but I don't agree with that point of view. And the reason is because, objectively speaking, if, and this is an obligation that Catholics have, Protestants do not have this obligation. And in fact, nobody other than a Catholic has this obligation, but Catholics do have the obligation to get married according to what's called the church's canonical form. And that's just a way of describing the way that their marriage should take place in the context in which it should take place. So in a church, it could be a chapel, you know, there are ways in which it doesn't have to be the parish church necessarily. And with the parish priest or a priest, it could be a deacon also, acting as the official witness of this wedding. Because as you know, Sylvia, the ministers of the sacrament of holy matrimony are the two parties. The husband gives the sacrament to his wife, the wife gives the sacrament to her husband. And the priest or the deacon is there to formally recognize this and witness it. And it's really very simple. There's not that much involved here. It's always boggled my mind as to why some Catholics say, there's no way I'm going to do that. Well, why not? Why not? If you want to start off a happy life and you at least have some modicum of belief in Jesus, why wouldn't you want to even just have that bare minimum? But for any number of reasons, some people don't. So you could maybe say to her that this is a public act. Your sacrament, if you indeed wind up having a sacrament, it's a public act. In fact, marriage as a natural institution is a public act because it involves all of us. We all have a stake in the success of this married couple, even if it's not a Catholic. So that's one thing you can point out to her. And what that means then is that if you know that by so doing this, the Catholic is going to be in an invalid marriage, I personally don't see how you can say, okay, it's wrong, but I'm going to go celebrate it. There's a disconnect there to me. If it's wrong and it's invalid and now they're objectively living in a kind of sexual unlawfulness because they're living as husband and wife, even though the church would say, because you didn't get married according to the canonical form, this is an invalid marriage. You're not really married. So where I have to depart from that view that it's okay to go and just keep the peace and family relationship and all that, I don't think we can square that circle. At least I can't. So sad to say, even though I myself have not been in this position, I imagine at some point in the future I probably will be, but I haven't had to cross that bridge yet. But the advice that I would take if it were me would be, I love you, I support you, I want to be there with you, I want nothing more than that, but because of the circumstances of your wedding, I can't be there because by being there, it's going to say something that's not true, which is that I approve of this, or I think it's worthy of celebration. So can we just have you get married in the church, and then I can be there, and everything's fine. And I know that sometimes when this is asked, the person says, oh, okay, I'll do it that way, and everything is fine. So those are the thoughts that come to my mind as you ask the question. I'll tell you one thing, Sylvia, that this is a question, the one you're asking, that comes up endlessly. It's maybe not every show, but almost every show, at least somebody has the same question. And they're in the situation that you're in where you want to help the other person and you don't want to drive a wedge, but at the same time, you have to be true to what you know and what your principles are.
Yeah, how to... What if you know outright that it will cause like a point of, it will cause like a lot of friction or contention, and there's like, mm-hmm. personally, like there's been healing with this relationship after mm-hmm. the fallout of COVID and all that. And so that's been nice, but I know that like if I say this basically or point this out, it's going to cause a lot of problems possibly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I understand what you mean by that, and I'm the last person who wants any family friction. Sometimes it's inevitable. But I can't help but think about what Jesus said when he says, don't think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but the sword. Now, he's not prescribing how he wants it to be. He's describing how it often is. So when he says that, you know, when I I'm not coming to bring peace, but the sword. What he means by that is that there will necessarily be division. So he says, for I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies will be those of his own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. So these are all things that I think play into this bigger question that you're asking. Sometimes in a family setting, which is the most painful, sometimes you have to say, I can't go along with that. Even to keep the family peace, I can't compromise on something that I know isn't right. And it leads to that kind of friction and difficulty. And Jesus predicted it. So I would like to do anything to avoid it if possible, but I couldn't give you the advice to compromise on something so important in order to keep the peace, because that would be going along to get along. And sometimes you can do that, but it doesn't seem to me that this is one of those times. Well, thanks, Sylvia. I appreciate it. If only there were more time, but that's all the time we've got today. And I hope you have a wonderful, hopefully it's a long weekend for you, taking the 4th of July off. I hope you have good times with your family, safe and sane, as they say with the fireworks. Let's remember to thank God for the benefits and blessings that we've received as Americans and this country's history, which, of course, is far from perfect, far, far, far from perfect, and many problems. Nonetheless, we can be grateful to God for all the things that we have enjoyed as American citizens. And let's pray that God will stay with us and protect us so that we can get better and do better as time goes on. Well, with that, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.